there, and welcome to the latest episode of the Sith Taker Snapshots podcast. I'm your host, Rich Polly, and joining me is man of leisure, moaning about cover letters, Liam Baker.
Buongiorno. Just accept my CV and do one.
currently wrestling a hyperactive 7-year-old Ben Hibbert.
He's actually 8.
Okay. I'm paying attention, totally am, swear.
Sorry, I can't remember your kid's age. I'm sure one of them's the same age as mine.
Right. Also joining us today is dispensing employment recruitment and how to do CVs advice, Tim King.
Hello there.
Hello. And that's it's basically a full house of Sith Takers today, as we're going to go through. I think this is possibly and probably going to be our last show where we're kind of focusing backwards on worlds. We're also going to be looking forward a little bit onto like the next couple of months worth of X-Wing. We're kind of on the cusp of the new competitive season. Last time, points dropped 2 weeks before UK Games Expo, which was towards the middle to the back end of May. So we're looking at this and thinking, if there's going to be a points change, it's going to come in the next kind of 6 or 8 weeks. If there isn't going to be a points change, we're going to sit with these worlds points or points from the pre-worlds points change. And we're going to have these for the next 12 months. So big caveat stuck right on the front of everything that we're going to talk about today, because this is either going to be a useful podcast for the next 12 months or it's going to be pointless within 6 weeks. So let's see what happens.
I kind of hope it's pointless in 6 weeks.
I do too.
But that's only me.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go through not the lists individually from Worlds, because everybody's kind of devoured those and looked over them, but we're going to kind of look through the archetypes. And we're going to talk a little bit about what makes these good lists. And we're also going to talk a little bit about strategies and tactics. A little bit of, it doesn't really work in a voice-only medium, but like conversations about like how you might turn zero in general terms, how you might deploy, that kind of stuff to try and get favorable engagements against these kinds of lists. The reason we're doing this is because post-Worlds, everybody looks at the lists that do well and says, I'm going to try those. I'm going to see how they are. I'm going to have a go and see what they feel like. So we are going to see a lot of these lists around as people just test them. And then we're going to see the new stuff, the Battle Over Endor stuff. People are clearly going to want to play with their new toys when they get them in the next couple of weeks. We believe they're now kind of due to hit our shores kind of this week and next. So we're just going to start. Before I kick off, does anybody want to make any start announcements before we do that? Or any big conversational pieces that we need to talk about?
I think, like, we could be getting a points update in 6 weeks, but there are events already starting to crop up. So, like, we've got the Sheffield team event coming beginning of May. You know, there's a few one days coming up. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that this, you know, at least be relevant for a few weeks and maybe just help people think about it. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of, this is something I messaged the group about, is our listener base is going to have a wide range of abilities and, you know, perhaps experience at the game. So there'll be some players out there that are very new to the game or, you know, perhaps don't play these lists, and hopefully this information will be useful for them. And I appreciate there's obviously some very experienced players out there that probably think, oh, I know all this, but I sometimes find listening to this information gets my mind thinking or gets my brain thinking about certain list builds and perhaps how I can take something and tinker with it and, you know, certain abilities I didn't really consider maybe, and then have it listening to other people talk about it. So I think that's kind of what we want to sort of get out of today's sort of podcast, is, you know, a bit of thinking about, you know, what's good, what's bad. And like, I think when you play something, you need to have that plan in your head, like, how can I beat that list? And hopefully that's what we may be talking about today.
Yeah. So, yeah, a little bit about what makes lists good, a little bit about how we can devise a plan. Before we dive into that, I'm going to mention this again at the end, but aware that people's attention drifts in the middle. So I'll do start and I'll do end. Sith Taker Open 2025 tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. on the 30th of April, so in about 2 weeks-ish, less than 2 weeks from time of recording. That is a very particularly picked date because it's after most people get paid. And it's a little bit far enough in the future that it allows us to do the necessary admin with Element to get everything up and ready. If you want to track the process of, by which Ryan Coyle is making the X-Wing fighter pilot helmet, which is going to be the prize for the winner this year, then if you follow him on Eccentric, which I can't spell, it's I-K-S-E-N-T-R-I-K. But if you follow him anywhere, basically Ryan Coyle, he's starting to post pictures of some of the other customs that he's doing in the same kind of style that he's going to do ours in. So you'll be able to probably start to see the beginnings of our bit as well. So I'm following it with great interest. That said, let's dive into the main meat of today. If we're going to talk about big archetypes that did well at Worlds, there is one that we have to start with, because in the top 16, it appeared 6 times. And if we include Tim's Republic Swarm, it appeared 7 times, but Tim's Republic Swarm is a bit different. So let's talk about Siege of Coruscant, Oddball, Wolf, Jag, and then 8 points worth of what's your flavor? Usually now, Y-Wings or Torrents. So this one Worlds with Illy, who we spoke to last week, with 2 Y-Wings and 1 Z95. It came second with Jorge with 2 Torrents and 1 Z95. It came third with Marco with a slightly different variation. So he traded out one of his arcs for Mace Windu as a Delta, and then 2 Z95s and broadside. So 2 arcs and Mace. Is he basically serving the same purpose, but on a small base, maybe? And so on, we go down the list. So we've got Mulfar, we've got Le Chancelier. You know, we've got a lot of people here kind of flying very similar lists into cut, and also flying them not into cut as well. They were everywhere you looked, there was clone swarms. So what makes this list or this archetype good to start off with? Why is it a good list? Liam, what's your opinion?
Well, I think if you look at the main core of it, the 3 arcs, they sit there with 4 shields, 5 hull. Six hull, three shields.
Apart from Oddball, who gets 4 shields.
They're medium bases, and they can all double tap because they've all got veteran tower gunner. Oddball gets the extra shield and has selfless, which helps keep the other arcs alive. They've all got the astromech that allows their turns to go down a difficulty, I believe, which makes them a little more maneuverable, which sometimes they do struggle with. And it's the fact that it's 3 3-dice guns that are all difficult to destroy. With Jag in there as well, they've all got a focus target lock because that just keeps cycling. And as a basis, I think we're seeing it come out at 28 hull in total that you need to chew through to get 12 points. And we've all seen it, and it feels bad, but the amount of times I've seen a 1 agility ship roll a constant evade is unreal.
Yep.
And they just stick around. And it's that alone which makes this such a difficult thing to chew through, and why it's such a fantastic foundation for a Republic list.
Just a slight correction or two. So Wolf doesn't have the droid. He's got a useless droid that allows him to barrel roll onto obstacles. And Oddball can't double mod his attacks. So the Wolf-Jag combo is the double modding thing. Oddball basically triggers it with a single modded shot at I-5 normally. But yeah, other than that, yeah, pretty much spot on.
So, I mean, that's the interesting thing. So just looking at Marco's list as an outlier, he's taken Mace, but he's actually brought Build Your Own Wolf. So he has actually brought R4P on his wolf. So R4P, for those who don't know, is a two-charge droid where you reveal your maneuver, spend the charge, make the basic maneuver easier. So turning your white maneuvers blue, but you can also turn that red hard three into a white maneuver, and that can catch people out. But yeah, as Rich has said, the double modding. So Drag can take target locks after a friendly in the side arc shoot. So generally, Oddball will shoot, Drag acquires a lock. When Wolf shoots, Wolf has Wolf Pack, which allows him to spend friendly Siege of Coruscant target locks, or he can use his own ability to reroll one dice. But even if you spend that target lock with Wolf Pack, Jag could then potentially reacquire another lock. And so it's basically reacquiring and spending the same lock multiple times, which allows a lot of efficiency to come out there.
Yeah. And then it follows up. It's not just the arcs that make the archetype. No. Keep making that same accidental pun. It's the filler, because the Siege of Coruscant ships have all got Born for This. So as well as all of those ferocious offensive modifications, the more Siege of Coruscant ships you've got in your list, the more token communism you've got going on. As, you know, Kickback takes an evade token or a focus token, you know, if Oddball doesn't have to spend his focus, doesn't get a chance to spend his focus, then that's everyone's focus for defense, and so on. The thing that Illy had in his list was he had a copy of Dedicated on Slider, so he opted to throw that defensive reroll in. Now, the couple of games I saw that he played on stream, Slider was flanking, and that wasn't really relevant. But later on in one of the games, there was an arc, a range check for a dedicated reroll that converted a blank into a focus, into an eyeball, which meant he could spend somebody else's focus and do that kind of trick.
Well, I mean, dedicated is what essentially cost me the game versus Andrew. You know, it was that reroll. But I mean, for me, that it's not so much the offense of the three arcs that's the problem. It is the defensiveness of it. And, like, whenever I play against three arcs, the first thing I'm looking at doing is, how, you know, is Oddball in the middle of that pack? And if Oddball is, then Oddball has to be the priority target, because Selfless to start with is really annoying. And, you know, if you end up saying, well, I want to go and target down Jag, because that's where the target locks are coming from, every crit you roll, if Oddball's in the arc and at range one of Jag, then a crit at a time can basically just be moved across. And with an extra shield, you end up splitting your damage. But it's the Born for This ability is really useful, because it's just a range two bubble. So there's no side arc or anything like that. And so you're seeing a lot of lists bringing the torrents now. And the torrents are either taking, sometimes you might just focus with Axe, because then obviously you have got the Barrage Rocket as well if you haven't spent your focus token. But Kickback pretty much always just evades. And then that's like, you know, if you've got a copy of Dedicated as well, it's that one green dice has become very efficient. And if you are either splitting your fire by either shooting two different targets, or you're shooting one target that's not Oddball, and those crits are being passed across with Selfless, you're just not putting enough red dice in one turn to take down an arc. So the first thing I try and do is think, well, am I going for Oddball? And if so, how many good shots can I get into Oddball to try and take him out in one go?
Because he's still got 10 health. That's the thing. 10 health with not quite a persistent evade, but, you know, I think 5 and 8 chance of evading. But if you count, he's got 6 focus tokens.
But it's either a 10 health Oddball, or it's a, what, 13 health Jag? Because, to be honest, you can still spend whole. Like, Selfless, if you've got 7 shots and you roll a crit on every single shot, then Oddball can just keep taking those crits away.
Yeah.
And one thing that's really great, it tends to work more when I was running with Padme and Luminara, is that you can make things like plasma torpedoes bounce. Mm-hmm. So if your opponent gets a bad roll, say rolls, I don't know, crit blank eyeball out of hand or something like that, and they're only able to mod up to, say, crit and a hit, you can selfless the crit off. And if you can get paint on that green dice with, you know, either your, you know, the evade token from kit back or the reroll from dedicated and stuff like that, if you can get that paint, then suddenly that plasma torpedo doesn't hit and doesn't strip the bonus shield.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that is absolutely massive. And I've done it a few times, and you know, I'll tell you, it is very satisfying.
You did it to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did it to a few people in Paris as well. And you know, it is really key, and it does catch a lot of people out with that selfless. It also catches people out. Occasionally, the ARC player misjudges the positioning, and then perhaps, you know, perhaps they've been a bit too brave a wolf, and you go all in at wolf, as it is to do with the attack arc and the range one or range 0-1. So if you can put damage into it, and they haven't got selfless, and you can get round selfless like that, and that does catch people out occasionally.
Yeah. Okay. So we know what the strengths of the of the list are. It's got basically two key strengths. One is its offensive power that it can throw out from the arcs with their double modded attacks, and one is the defensive shenanigans that it can do to ensure that those ships are staying alive. One of the weaknesses
we missed as well, that they take up a lot of board space.
Mm-hmm.
Like they can just dominate an area that you have to work around them.
I mean, that's kind of why I got bored with them a little bit, is that, and they're just, yeah, they're a very simple list. Good players have worked out ways of placing rocks that perhaps don't make it as easy. This is it. Like once you get them into a space, you start, you know, leveraging that front and rear arc. It's just so many shots are coming out of them. And in a way, like, you don't really care about the focus tokens, because there might be chances of getting, like, multiple target locks, spending them, reacquiring locks, and it can be horrible. And just rolling four red dice at range one with, you know, target lock focus or even a single mod can push through an awful lot of damage.
Yeah. So, like, as Ben pointed out, they take up a lot of space. And I guess one of the things we'll move on to when we talk a little bit about the strategies with and against them is how you play each of the scenarios with them, because this is where these conversations get complex, because each of these lists will do better or worse in different scenarios against other lists depending on what they're playing into, kind of thing. So there's a lot of ifs, ands and maybes about all of these conversations. The weakness of this list is that it kind of, well, for me, I think the weakness of the list is that it is one agility. So if you can engineer a good engage where you snag one of the ships or two of the ships at range three, and then you can initiative kill something, because it's relatively low initiative compared to some of the other things. I think that there's an obvious first target in Oddball. So experienced players will try and protect Oddball because he is the obvious first target. But in terms of weakness, I think the primary weakness is that it's like a counterpoint to the benefit that Ben said, which is that it takes up a lot of space. It's not easy to navigate those three arcs through dense clusters of rocks. They tend to start self-bumping quite a lot, whether on purpose or by accident. And I think we saw, I can't remember what tournament it was one of the ones in America, might have been Nova, where the winner was actually deliberately self-bumping the ships because they knew that, or they felt that the locks would do enough work And it might have been Jorge actually doing it.
So two things on that point, actually, just remind me about Oddball's ability. But yeah, absolutely. Like, it's a 50-50 chance that you take damage to a self-bump. So sometimes if it's better for position, then you just take the self-bump rather than perhaps putting yourself out of position just to get the focus token. Because with the Born for this ability, you don't need the focus for defense because there's potential for one of the torrents maybe, or one of the other arcs will have taken a focus that you can then spend for defense. But Oddball's ability is actually really good with the sort of the 2.5 rules. So Oddball, when he does a red action, he can then a friendly ship at range 0-3 can lock an enemy ship at 0-1 of Oddball. And so what you can actually do is you can engineer it so that you get a bump. So Oddball gets blocked either by an enemy ship or a friendly ship. But if you can make sure that it counts as bumping an enemy ship, you get to do your red focus and then take a lock. So that is one way you can get Oddball double modded for his shot. And sometimes it's better to pass a lock over to somebody else. Like if Oddball hasn't got arc, or you know, maybe has only got the rear shot, you might give the target lock to somebody else. Because you can give the lock to, say, Kickback to fire the Diamond Borer missile or something like that. But the fact it triggers off a red focus is really good.
Yeah, it is good. It is good. So what, as I said, Ben, when you look at this kind of archetype, it plonks down opposite you on the table. What do you think its weaknesses are, and what are you trying to achieve with your squad, irrespective of what your squad is? What do you look at and think, that's how I'm going to open this up and get a win here?
I mean, I think Tim sort of touched on it earlier, was you try and get your rocks in positions that you think are awkward for them. Maybe like, you know, when we're on, I can't think of what it's called now, we've got to be near the objectives. People try and get like those little triangles,
assault.
You know, putting rocks in assault, putting rocks in the middle of it. When I play it, it depends how they set up, but if possible, I want to make them fly their arcs to me. I don't want to set up in front of their arcs. But the other again, like, I always try and engineer to get one of the arcs, not all of them if possible. And I just try and take one out, because I think if you can take one out, obviously Oddball's a better choice, but if you can take any of them out, it severely weakens that. I don't think there is quite the punch when there's two compared to the three.
Yeah, and that's a topic that we'll come on to in a minute when we start talking about the Rebel B-Wings, because that kind of holds, there's a lot of combo going on here, and it's a very simple combo. There's been a long time thing in X-Wing where people build these overly complicated constructs of abilities triggering, if this happens, then that happens, then I can do this and I can do that. And if you do that, then I'll do something else. And all it takes is for your opponent to just say, well, I'm not gonna do that. So you can't do all that kind of thing. You know, they can switch off your machine quite easily. Or there's like one key piece that's relatively easy to kill that they can go for. I think you're right. It doesn't matter which ship you take off, but it has to be an arc, basically.
So Jag is the machine of the whole thing. But whilst Oddball's there, personally, I would always go after Oddball, and I'm happy as the arc player if you're not shooting Oddball, because there's always going to be chance that you are going to roll crits. Sometimes if your opponent's offering, you know, you, oh, don't forget you can use marksmanship to change that hit to a crit, you know, your spidey sense should be tingling, and maybe you don't take that option. But I'm quite happy that if you are not shooting Oddball,
given the choice, you would take Oddball. But ideally you wouldn't want to take on, if possible, you'd like it so maybe your ships are just in range of maybe one of them. You know what I mean? If you've engaged and they're all shooting you, it's probably already too late.
Yeah. So I mean, we're moving on to kind of the tactics now, and we'll keep this quite short-ish, because otherwise we'll talk about this one archetype for the whole podcast and it'll be terribly dull. So like we've already touched on the strategy, and it was something that I've seen Paul Heaver talk about in various places around the internet, which is that, you know, if you're playing against arcs, you need to have the biggest rocks you can, and you need to put them in the middle of the board, and you need to stop there, and you need to set up in the opposite corner from them, and you need to stop them from just jousting you as a death line of three, which they will do if you give them the opportunity to do it. So there's the old hourglass set up for rocks, which is where you have kind of four of your rocks just range one from each other around the central objective. Four of your rocks around about 2-2 or 2-3 from your corners, and then the other two kind of in the middle so that they make sort of an hourglass shape in the board, or with two like inverted Vs opposite each other. And that stops ships from doing a three forward and then a three bank or a two bank without hitting a rock, basically. You need to stick rocks on the table and look at it with templates and stuff to figure out exactly what I mean. But basically, you're stopping the ships from easily being able to bank in as a group. That kind of clustering up of the middle is really good for preventing them from being able to joust into you. But, you know, they can always separate out because, as Tim pointed out, a lot of the abilities don't care about range one. So this was an old tactic from flying against high swarms where everyone wanted to be range one of Hullrunner. But with this, they all kind of want to be range two of each other or in the side arc of another ship, which is a much more forgiving kind of setup. But you can maybe force a couple of them to engage late or, you know, make it more difficult for them to disengage or to re-engage or to turn away because you put rocks in a place where once they fly into that channel, they're locked into it. And then you can maybe get a flank on them and switch off some of their double taps and that kind of thing. So that's my kind of thought process around it. What's your brain tell you to do, Liam?
So I know they like to kind of fly in a formation. So I tend to... I want them to have to choose where they're going. I want to make their path towards me more difficult. I'm a firm believer that the more choices you give your opponent, the more opportunity you give them to make a mistake. So that's kind of the mantra I live by regarding this matchup. Primary target. If I want the machine to crumble, I'm looking at one of the arcs and I'm going to go for Jag possibly, because that kind of shuts down the constant double modded. I know they're hard to kill, but generally with the right list, you should be able to burn an arc down a turn. It's just whether you burn the right arc down a turn. So I just think when you encounter a list like this, you can lose it before you've put a ship on the board. You've got to start looking at how you do your list composition. Can I put enough reds out? What does my turn zero look like? And basically, you've got to give your opponent so many more choices. Give them give them some bait, give them something to chase, make them make choices. And then the more 50-50s your opponent has, eventually they'll get one wrong.
Oh, I've just realized I muted myself because I was coughing and then I didn't unmute. I said, cool. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like, and I'd not thought about it that way before, because I always thought about trying to force them into a single choice that was good for me and bad for them. But I suppose giving them multiple choices where you can flex your approach around them is basically giving them lots of bad decisions that they can choose the least worst option. And eventually they'll choose the worst option. So, who wants to come in on that one? I can see Ben and Tim have both unmuted themselves. So I'm like, ooh.
I just come back. I nipped away.
All right. Okay. Fair enough. All right. So that's kind of the arcs. In summary, they're really good. You have to try and outmaneuver your opponent to get a better first engagement. And there's a lot of stuff you can do to try and do that. But first among the things is not to give them a big, massive open space in the middle of the board. And for all the reasons to not take big rocks, opponents flying three arcs is probably the primary reason to take big rocks. If we talk a little bit about the scenarios, we've already talked on touched on assault at the satellite array. They will try and get objectives close to each other and then try and fly through that area so that they get lots of free points, just because they've got three medium bases in there dominating all of those objectives. You can switch that off in turn zero by putting rocks in those dense triangles of objectives that they create. But it is a tough engagement against, or it's a tough scenario to play against the arcs.
So the issue you've got there is that you have to go and challenge the objectors, really. And then if you've got multiple arcs plus support ships sat on them, then you know there's lots of red dice coming in. So that's assault is probably one of their easiest scenarios, and it's one of the reasons why obviously I moved over to small rocks with the arcs. So if I win road, then I'm putting two large rocks, two and two, in your corners, and just getting them out the way, like you mentioned. I think salvage is a pretty good scenario for them, especially if they've got the Y wings. You know, the amount of times I've just been towing, you know, with my headhunter or something like that, and it's like, well, do I shoot the arc, or like, you know, Padme and Luminara are the ones that tend to carry salvage crates for me, because then you have that choice, like you say, you want to be killing the arcs because you want to get the red dice off the board, but actually it's the other ships that are scoring the objective points, and whichever scenario I play, I'm always trying to outscore my opponents. And with salvage and scramble, you can afford with Republic for your ships to do the scenario objectives as their action, and then they're still getting green tokens from other ships, and that's where that Born for This ability is really strong. So like, even scramble's decent for Republic, because you know, you can opt to have, like, my V-wings will normally in my list will go and scramble objectives because they've got three agility, and then my other ships have got the green tokens. So then, yes, you can shoot my tokenless V-wing that's just done the scramble, but I've still got three greens and a focus and an invade if I want to, and dedicated rerolls.
To be honest, for all the reasons we've talked about before, I think this is possibly the biggest strength of the squad, is that it doesn't have a bad scenario. It doesn't, like, irrespective of what it's playing into, each of the four scenarios, all of the ships are difficult to get points out of for chance. All of the ships can pick up a crate if they want to, for salvage because of Born for This. All of them can tag objectives and scramble because of Born for This. And then when you're talking about assault, they've got three medium bases and then another three ships that can just fly off and tag objectives in corners. If they cycle out and they're on low health, they can disappear off and score points. Now, Magic and Broadside can't disappear very quickly, but they can disappear.
And let's not forget as well, like, you know, chatting with Billy last week, you know, he would use Slider, send him off after an objective, and then he can just slide around on an objective scoring points. And same with me with Boost, you know, your 2-point headhunter, you know, if you're Boost goes off, picks up a crate, holds it for three turns, then he's already made, you know, more than his points back. You know, the Y-wings holding crates and just being annoying, and yes, they're one agility, but again, that, you know, the Y-wings have got an ability that if there's a crit, it has to get rolled down to a hit, and then with Selfless as well, it's very hard to land crits on those, which makes them very good salvage carriers. And then you got the Torrents. I mean, like, you know, the Torrents, like, you know, you talk about chance and easy points. I mean, all these ships are like 3 points, the small ships, and those Torrents are 2 agility, 6 health. So yeah, trying to get, you know, your half points out of them can be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the thing that makes this possibly the best list in the game at the moment, is that it's got a lot of redundancy. It can can survive a lot of mistakes, and things can just live forever. But it also doesn't have a big weakness, I would say. So we're going to move on. unless me saying it doesn't have a big weakness has triggered something in somebody's head, to what I'm loosely calling five ship rebels. So we had four instances of five ship rebels went into cut. Three instances went out in top 16, one went out in top four. So the one that went out in top four was Battle of Endor, Wedge, Gina, Braylon, Gemmer, and then Keel Venzi with Duke and Vectored Cannons. So four Battle of Endor ships and possibly the best A-Wing in the game, which is saying a lot because there's a lot of good A-Wings. We also had an instance that was Braylon and Gina from Battle of Endor, but then Battle of Yavin Luke, Hera in an A-Wing, and Sabine in a TIE fighter. So Hera giving that token sharing, not as good as Born for this, but still pretty good. And then we had an instance that was Actor Khan flying Fen Rao in a Rebel Fang, Keo Venzi with Lone Wolf, then Battle of Yavin Luke, Battle of Endor, Wedge, and Sabine in a TIE fighter. The last one, why I say loosely calling these, is a totally different archetype. I'll say totally different archetype. It's Hera in an A-Wing, Bodica in a Fang, Sabine in a TIE fighter, Hall Okand in a Y-Wing, and then Lando Calrissian with Perceptive Copilot and Biston. So Didalotra basically flying the old Han list, but trading Lando in to get the loadout points needed to get Perceptive Copilot and Biston, but losing the Han reroll, but gaining Lando's ability to take two actions with his last, with his Nien Num co-pilot in there, giving him blue banks. So, say that there was another couple of these floating around right on the edges. So we had a four-ship Rebel with Mega Silver, with Battle Over Endor, Wedge, Battle Over Yavin, Luke, Fen Rao and a Fang, and then Hera in a B-Wing. Doing a bunch of token passing. And then we had the Benthic two tubes list from Matt Deering, with Endor, Wedge, Yavin, Luke, Keo, Sabine, and Benthic. So there was six of these in the top 20, with Lando being kind of the different ship. So what is it that makes, let's think about the B-Wings first of all, because they were the ones that kind of went the furthest into the tournament, making top four, the only non-Republic list to make top four. What is it that makes these B-Wings so good? What makes them good? Ben?
Well, they're basically heavily modified, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Like, both of them are, it's quite easy to get sort of double mods on them, isn't it? If I remember rightly, can't Gina get like a target, a focus or something if Braylon's stressed? Braylon can have a target lock if she's stressed.
Yeah, other way around, but yeah.
Or is it the other way around?
Yeah.
But they're both like, B-Wings are really easy to stress. And again, they're just big three dice guns, aren't they? Or both of them have got like missiles and torpedoes on. And just, then there's the bombs that are pumped out either from the side. If they want, can't they spend a charge to get an evade as well, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, so both of
them
have got...
I've only actually seen them on the table once myself.
Yeah, both of them have got two charges, and they can spend both charges to, when they gain a stress, to gain an evade token. So every other turn, they can gain that free evade token. But
which is great on a single dice.
Yeah, Gina has Duke and Proton Torpedoes. So she's throwing double-modded Duked Proton Torpedoes at I5. So she's not likely to have spent that evade token at that point, unless you're trying to take her down with aces, at which point she spends her evade to not be dead and then fires a double-modded proton torpedo back at you anyway. Liam, you can talk about these B-Wings. You've seen them in action a couple of times.
Yeah, it seems like points-efficient double mods. Again, nine health ships with easily obtainable double mods, it's difficult to get round. And in conjunction with the Duke ability that they can get, B because they spend two charges to get an evade token, it just makes it hard to defend against.
So that's the B-Wings.
Yeah, so when you partner the B-Wings in with the other key pieces in Rebels, such as Luke, who is another double-modded proton torpedo carrier, you can kind of see a pattern forming with what is actually available to you, and it's just one big alpha strike. You've got ships that can take a punch, although it's rare that I see Luke roll eyeballs. So his ability doesn't really proc. But when you face three or four double-modded proton torps in a game, even in the first two engagements, it's very rare you've got all your ships or you've got your big hitter left. And it's just really difficult to avoid. You need to start looking at anti-lock tech. So do you take chaff? Do you take things that can jam? Ions, but you've also got to make sure you engage these weapons and tactics at a high enough initiative that they're relevant. And it's just really difficult to get around.
Yeah. I mean, there were quite a lot of instances of this kind of archetype in Worlds. It was one of the, I think it was actually the most common archetype was the two B-Wings and X-Wing. And I think it was two A-Wings, but it might have been a one A-Wing. But the kind of the combination, the jigsaw pieces, is quite incredible, because you've also got Battle Over Endor Wedge in his basically a T-70 with his advanced proton torpedoes double modded, and then Predator for all of the rest of his shots, and two focus tokens basically all the time. The way that Paul had his list kind of filled out with Keo and Gemmer meant that he had two objective runners. So he had his two A-Wings to go and capitalize on picking up crates, tagging objectives and scramble, both of them having vectored cannons so they could pre-boost in the systems phase to get out of dodge or to get into weird places or to just disappear like seven straight across to the other side of the board to pick up an objective where nobody else is looking at them and snag up some points. Both of these A-Wings are incredibly good at staying alive, because in this kind of list, they're not there to deal damage. There's, you know, whatever it is, 14 points of the list that is there to punch you in the face, and then the 6 points remaining is there to scoop up points where they can. But Tim, did you play against any of these when you were at Worlds on your run through?
Yeah, I played Nicholas, I felt that if I'd beaten Andrew, that I was quite happy playing Paul in the top eight, because essentially the B-Wings are very similar to ARCs, and I know I can take out a B-Wing or an ARC in one round of shooting, just with the one agility. They are interesting, as in, you know, getting the evade, the focus, and all that sort of stuff, but much like the ARCs, you know, they can only spend that evade once, and yeah, if I can put enough damage in, you know, they can be a problem. But I mean, I think I took out, I was going to go after Braylon because I could initiative kill Braylon, because I have several shots at initiative 5 with my swarm tactics, and Braylon being a 4, I felt that I could initiative kill him. But I actually ended up with better shots into Gina, so I decided not to initiative kill Braylon and ended up just taking Gina off in one round of shooting instead. Which I think Nicholas was with, not upset, but wasn't expecting. And that's just how my list worked. His Wedge did a lot of work. And I was actually, it was the first time that I'd actually played against somebody who ran Battle of Endor Wedge well. So he has got a few abilities that just made him punch a bit harder than I expected. So the R2A3. After you perform an action, you may spend a charge to acquire a lock. I went to block Wedge, and then I went a bit too quick with kickback. And if I'd realized this, I probably wouldn't have gone as quick. And I ended up getting a double modded advanced proton torpedo, because he did the red focus, which then meant he could then acquire a lock and fire that into kickback, which was it tickled, you know, but ultimately killing Gina was good for me. And I think he ran Luke as well, and Luke got heavily battered the next turn, just with Bullseye from the barrage rocket and stuff like that. So it was, it's tricky. I played against Cormac Higgins at Sift Taker Open, and I think I had four or five good shots into Gemma. But my good shots turned out to be average shots. And then with Gemma's ability and other, you know, rolls and bits and bobs, just meant I wasted all my shots into Gemma. But that was good experience for me, like going forwards into other games, to know that, you know, Gemma, like you say, is not a damage dealer. So actually I'm better off. I probably should have shot Keo or Luke that turn. Like, taking Luke off the board would have been big for the end game.
Yeah. I mean, Gemma's a bit of a weird one because, he's not a primary damage dealer, but he does have like a CLT style missile, and he does get a free mod when he engages. If he spent his focus token on defense, he gets a free calculate. So like, it's one of those weird low initiative ships that will probably just plink damage because everybody spent all their tokens, and then here comes the two dice range three obstructed shot, does hit crit and kill Sun Tirfel kind of event going on. So you know, it's one of those kind of weird ships, but he's a bit like Finn from Resistance. He is a ship that you don't shoot unless you're shooting him twice, at least with good shots, and preferably three times if you want to try and kill them. The question then you've got to ask yourself is it worth the maybe I kill Gemma with these three good shots versus the I'll definitely get some points or do some palpable damage into somebody else? Because yeah, that the ability. So Gemma's ability basically allows you to convert blanks to eyeballs for the cost of a strain. So you can, like, if you roll an eyeball and two blanks and you've got a focus token, you get suddenly three eyeballs. You dodge three damage, and then you take a strain, and the next shot you're only rolling two greens, but you've already dodged the worst of something horrible happening to you. So he's pretty nigh unkillable as long as he's got a focus token, without taking two good shots into him. So yeah, I mean, looking at the other kind of ships, so the other instances of this kind of archetype, Paul clearly went heavy into Battle Over Endor with four very strong ships, and as I said, Keo with Duke and Vectored Cannons. Kind of the next instance of a rebel placing was, I think, 11th, I'm going to say, which was Sans Oft Blue, who flew kind of the two B-wings with Luke, we've already talked about, but then put a little bit more token sharing in as well with Hera in an A-wing and Sabine just rounding out the points because Hera's a bit more expensive as a four-point A-wing. That just adds just another dynamic to it, doesn't it? Hera can take an evade token to keep Luke alive, can pass evade tokens to Gina so she can duke if she spent it on other turns. All sorts of shenanigans possible with an evading A-wing. Or she can grab a lock at I-6 and pass that to somebody if they've not been able to acquire a lock for whatever reason. It's a pretty cool little tweak. But I don't think it fundamentally changes how the archetype plays. I think it's fundamentally the same. As you said up front, Liam, it's a big hyper alpha with a couple of support ships, right?
Yeah. And I just think it's really difficult to get behind because it's unlikely you'll kill something, but it's very likely you'll lose something. And it's, I think it's just the current state of the game where there's a few factions, as we've already discussed with about Republic, where you can get enough ships to do a lot of damage, but also not take enough damage back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly to do with a higher ship count meta. We're seeing five ship lists as your basic. what am I trying to say? Yeah, it's what you generally encounter in an event, yeah. And where three or four of those ships can put out those shots, as we're seeing, it's mainly the new packs that are coming out that are giving you the opportunity to do this, which is why they're so popular, because you can always capture more points than your opponent if you've got more ships.
Yeah. So, like, if we look down to the list that made top 16 but didn't make it beyond that, they didn't have the B-Wings in them. So we've already talked about Sands of Blue. And then we've got the Lando list, which is, we've talked a lot about the old hand lists and how they work. But this one's got kind of an interesting, I think, confused target priority, because you've got a Hera with Swarm Tactics who can bump Boudica up so that Boudica gets to do their shot and their revenge shot with full dice without not having to take a deplete for the revenge shot. Then you've got Lando double tapping with a focus target lock on one shot and just a focus on the second shot. You've got Hall, who's threatening an advanced proton torpedo at all times, as long as he's still alive, because if any of his friends get killed, he goes for them. So the confusing target priority is Hera is swarming Boudica, so you want to kill Hera, and his token passing, so you want to get rid of that. Lando is double tapping, so you maybe want to get rid of that. Boudica is double tapping, but only if you don't shoot at Boudica, so you want to shoot at Boudica. But if you kill Boudica, then Hall is going to get the APT off, so do you want to shoot Hall? So it's all very kind of... In fact, the only ship here you don't want to kill first is probably Sabine, followed by Lando. The other three have kind of got a very confusing... And I can see a lot of people just kind of going into paralysis about who they need to shoot on this. And even thinking about it, not standing at a table with pressure on, it's difficult to kind of think where you want to target things. I don't know.
I mean, I'm just sitting here staring at it. I still can't decide who I would actually go for.
Yeah. I mean, the other one.
Awkward choices, isn't there?
I don't think there's necessarily good or bad choices. Like, it's... If you're going after the damage dealers, so the B-Wings, the X-Wings, I think they're the ones you go after.
So in this list, without B-Wings and X-Wings, we'd be looking at Boudica and Hull. They're the damage dealers, basically, and Lando. So you're going to have to chase down one of the three ships that's double-tapping you, because they're... one of the two double-tapping ships, or just go for Hull. Which Hull is a three-pointer, so they're probably happy for you doing that. And then the same on the other side. It's got the X-Wings, Khan's list with Rebel Fang, Fenn, Keo, Luke, Endor Wedge, and Sabine. So again, it's the big... It's another version of the high power Alpha Strike. This Fenn Rao has a swarm tactic, so Luke is shooting his torps at six, or Keo is popping ion missiles out at six is the other possibility.
Well, it's Boudica as well, isn't it? It's Boudica being able to shoot normally before the revenge shot.
Yeah, both of these, even the one that doesn't have Boudica, Khan's list doesn't have Boudica but does have swarm tactics on Fenn. And then it's, you know, there's a 6-6-5-3-3, so it's probably going on to Keo to use that iron missile to strip locks, I suspect.
Because that's the one thing we didn't really talk about with the arcs, is that is one way to get around them, is to stop them taking locks. So, you know, you are starting to see a few people taking ion weapons to be able to ionize ships so that they can't take locks.
Yeah. Yeah, people bringing those. And that was actually something that... we didn't talk about with the Y-Wings in the Republic thing as well, is that the ion cannon turrets, while absolute garbage on salvage mission, are absolutely hilarious on any mission where you come up against aces, because you just point those turrets to the side and you dare the aces to come in. And if they come into the side, they get either an ion cannon turret, an ion bomb, or a proton bomb.
I mean, they're great in chance as well, because that's the issue I suffered with, is the fact that they're rolling three or four red dice, kind of double modded with the Y-Wing's abilities. So one of them is it gets to re-roll red dice for each red token on it, so generates friendly locks. And then the other one, I think, can spend a focus to do something. But essentially, there's just too many red dice being rolled for my ships, and they're all just taking one damage. So it wasn't necessarily the ions that was doing the problem. It was all those little instances of taking one damage that really cost me the game in chance.
Yeah. And then those turns where you just find yourself pointing in the wrong direction because you're ionized for that one turn. You know, a turn where you say, I have no shots, is always a bad turn, which happens sometimes and it always feels bad. So the kind of the rebel lists, like we think, like the general kind of macro level strategy is to go after the things that are going to be doing damage and try and take them off as quickly as possible, whether that's B-wings or X-wings. B-wings and X-wings do die if you have multiple shots on them. The challenge here is in trading up, because they're quite high initiative. So they'll be popping initiative kills off, other than Braylon, who's eminently at I4 in the bottom tier of initiatives at the moment, which is weird to say. So if you're thinking about turn zero against these ships, what kind of a setup are you looking for? I'll ask you, Liam, because you always think about these things in great detail.
Well, it depends what I'm using. If I go from a competitive angle, I'll be using my FO. I'm looking at what target suffers most from not having mods, how quickly I can take that down, and what ships I can kind of put at the forefront that I either don't mind losing or I feel can handle a bit of fire. So I'll probably leave Malorus, send Whirlwind in. It'll be at that point where I'm deciding if I'm just focus jamming or just taking a lock. Because if I know I'm not getting two shots with the clusters, I would rather just get a four dice bullseye shot in. And it's about crippling something before it can shoot, possibly removing it from the board, and then just being able to identify which I can pull apart next. So it's point at a target, kill something. Luke always seemed rather squishy. But obviously with his, is it the R3 Astromech where he gets the regen? It's something you've really got to one turn. Otherwise, you'll probably never see Luke again. And then, knowing my luck, he'll rock around in the last turn, take an instinctive aim torpedo, then hit me for four and kill something in one. So it's find the linchpin of the list. So in Rebels, everything can kind of work independently, minus the B-Wings.
Mm-hmm.
Gina has more damage output because I don't mind taking a single damage from Braylon's homing missile. So it's kill Gina and kill Gina before she gets to fire. Jam off any mod she has and just pray I survive the return salvo from everything else. And then what does survive? Murder that. Next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we mentioned it a little bit earlier, didn't we, that the killing one of them, the B-Wings, because they rely on each other for the double mods. So if you can take Braylon off, Gina doesn't get free locks. If you can take Gina off, Braylon doesn't get free focuses. The other one becomes a lot easier to kill. They're as difficult to kill, but not quite as scary because you don't have the double bombs out the back and sides as well. So, it's an easy thing to say, but a hard thing to do because, as we've already discussed, they've got, you know, Braylon might have two focuses and an evade token when you come to engage him. Gina's got a focus and an evade token and a lock. And, you know, they've also, which we've not talked about, and probably one of the reasons why the B-Wings and Wedge and the other Endor ships are doing well, is that they very seldom take meaningful damage on the first engagement because they've got It's a Trap. So It's a Trap is garbage once things have actually got into the mix, because you need to have N plus one ships around you. So if you've got one enemy ship, you need to have two other friendlies. So you need to be a three on one. But if they're shooting you at range three and you've got one mate sitting next to you, you get a free defensive reroll of blanks. So with all those mods that the B-Wings are sitting on and a reroll on defense, then they just basically don't take damage. But if they're shooting you at range three, Gina's popping you with a proton torpedo. Brayden's popping you with three dice double modded attack. You're probably taking damage and they're probably not. Or not meaningful damage anyway. So it was like coming back to kind of similarities to the Republic list. It was the it's the fact that they're difficult to kill, that they've got easy access to double modded shots, and they don't give up points easy. In terms of scenarios, though, I think that this list does have weaknesses. It relies heavily on the A-Wings to go and tag points, but they're small base ships, so they find it difficult to get more than one or two a turn. I think there's a lot of lists out there that can just bully these off objectives, so they need to really rely on killing ships to win games. But, you know, that's a choice. Is that fair? Ben, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back this time. No, yeah, it's fair, but I mean, they are good at getting points as well, though, aren't they? You know, I know we struggle in the be near stuff one, but every other one, they're still great. I mean, when you pick up a crate, you can really, A-Wings are fast. Like, they can get away from things. There's not much that keeps up with an A-Wing if it decides to go.
Yeah. Yep. It's, I mean, I've been playing this over the last couple of weeks since I got back from Worlds, just to kind of see how badly I made decisions about not flipping to it before I went. And it turns out I made really bad decisions not flipping to it before I went, because it really does just feel like, I talked about Power Leap before, and this is one of those things that really is, like, this is the list that got closest to beating Illy. It went to a final salvo, apart from another Republic list that beat him in, I think, round two. And a lot of that is down to, you know, the quality of the piloting of it, because Paul is obviously an exceptional player. But this is the kind of list that can just obliterate Oddball in one turn of shooting. Or obliterate an arc in one turn of shooting, whatever happens. And it's high enough initiative that it's not going to then suffer from being initiative killed later on. And the Y-Wings aren't ever going to be able to catch or do anything meaningful to the A-Wings when it comes to objective game. So, yeah. Anyway, weaknesses. B-Wings are really easy to kill once you trap them. But I can't really think of any other weaknesses. It's a really nice combined arms squad with three really big hammers and two really nice little... They're not support ships, but they're like objective runners and kind of little harrying flankers and things that are annoying and very difficult to kill that might just distract opponents for that one turn you need to keep your B-Wings alive long enough to murder something else. But any last thoughts on Rebels?
I'd say that the B-Wings are very unmaneuverable as well, though, aren't they? Yeah. That could be a bit of a weakness there. They're quite easy to fly around. And then it's only really Wedges your damage dealer then, isn't he?
Yeah, you need to get them out of position and get behind them. That's kind of the tactic. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. Because with a one bank and a barrel roll, if they engage you on a good angle, with a one bank and a barrel roll, they can keep staying relevant. They can just turn around slowly that way and get shots on you. So you need to really think about where the B-Wings can end up, I think. Their options for clearing stress are very weak, though. They've got a one bank that is blue. And then straight moves. I think it's 1, 2, 3 straight blue. So they are hyper predictable once they're stressed, because, you know, I mean, they don't need to clear stress every turn. Braylon and Gina can just stay stressed, but then they're limiting the amount of mods that they get. But they do still get mods if they're both on the board and they're both stressed. Just one of each, not double modded. So, yeah. Cool.
I mean, that's all I was going to just comment on. I think, like, if you're comparing that, you know, the Rebel lists to the Republic lists, I think that the arcs are certainly more maneuverable in so much as they've got the rear arc. You know, they've got the, you know, they can make their hard turns and make them blue with obviously the droid and what have you. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to be more. I mean, I think the Republic list is certainly easier, but I don't know. It's certainly a good list, and it's nice to see some of the new stuff actually doing well.
Yeah,
because that's kind
of when Siege of Coruscant came out. I think the first thing everybody looked at was the Jedi, expecting kind of Battle of Yavin level, and were disappointed. And it's nice that the clones have kind of shone through in that pack. Nobody's yet found what's broken in Siege of Coruscant for Separatists. It might be all the extended stuff that is banned,
or the single tri fighter, or
yeah, like that one good tri fighter who's not enough to shore up the rest of the faction. But I think this is why everybody's excited about the potential future packs for standard loadouts, because if you get them for each of the other factions, then I think everybody's looking at what Rebels have done and what Republic have done and thought, when's it our turn? And we've not talked about Imperials yet, so we can talk about them now. Two instances of Imperials made it into top cut. They finished 5th and 9th. Three instances of Imperials. They finished 5th, 8th, and 9th. Two instances of Rear Admiral Shirinu made it into the top 8. And we'll talk about those two lists kind of together, because they're different but very similar. So we've got the Deathimator Rack build, which is the Death Troopers Darth Vader rack build that we've talked about a few times on the podcast before. But then, they both come with a Tomax Bren and a Deathfire from the TIE Bomber expansion pack. So that's kind of 13 points. And then you've got 7 points left over. Now, 5th place Chumbalaya took it as Colonel Jendon from Battle Over Endor. So the I-6 TIE Defender with all of his shenanigans that goes on there. And then Ahriman, who came in 8th spot, took Captain Feroff with 000 and Scythe 6, which is the... I don't know which one Scythe 6 is. Let me have a look.
I have not seen that one either.
So Scythe 6 is a Battle Over Endor ship that, while performs an attack at range 1 to 2, roll an additional attack dice, and comes with no escape, so you get offensive rerolls, Predator, so you get more offensive rerolls, Targeting Matrix to give the defender a strain token after you attack. At the end of the neutralized result steps, you can spend an eyeball to give the defender a strain token, and that's happening at I2, so maybe not hugely relevant. But then you've also got the ion maneuvering jet, which gives you essentially pattern analyzer after you do a K turn. You can spend a charge to perform an action even while stressed. So that's pretty cool. This list had Scythe 6, Deathfire, Tomax, Rack, and Feroff. Or trade out Scythe 6 and Feroff for Jendon. What makes this a good list? Who knows about Imperials? Ben knows about Imperials. Ben.
I've been flying a lot of this style of list. I haven't used that Scythe 6, to be honest. But I actually tried that Jendon Chernu list, and I've flown a lot of the Reapers. A lot of it is... Again, the bombers are there. I always use my bombers personally as my trade pieces. They do a lot of damage before they go. I mean, I've actually not been using Deathfire anymore, but even still, it's fine. They go in first, deal a load of damage, cause problems. That's when Cherno usually comes in afterwards and starts using them as extra mods, along with his Death Troopers, his Vader. And when I've been using Jendon, I usually just flank, because you get in target lock focus every turn. You get that evade when you need it. You get an extra turn to barrel roll, and it deals out such a lot of front up damage at high in initiative. Because Tomax again is like a double modded plasma initiative 5, You can really can wipe things out quickly. Personally, I prefer having the Ferroth Reaper because I think the medium base and the large base are great for the one where you have to be near stuff. I cannot remember it today at all.
Assault on the satellite array.
I just can't get it into my head. And then salvage where you pick it is salvage where you're picking up, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's thrown me off not getting that one. You know, Cherno doesn't mind picking up a crate. It doesn't bother him. Same as Ferroth, because you can be quite fast and people don't realise that you get, you know, you can still do the ailerons with the crate on there. I mean, I guess it's Ferroth, isn't it? Yeah, I like Ferroth because you get the evades and stuff when people attack you. It's hard to kill. A lot of other people have been using the, is it Psy? What's it called? No, it's not Psy. It's
Vizier with Palp.
Vizier, yeah. So you're getting a free, like, coordinate and things like that. I think it has got, it's good into the scenarios, and it does, like I say, people always forget that Death Troopers is disgusting, and I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up on a ban list at some point.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that
know what Death Troopers does is you can't remove stress at range 0 to 1 of Cherno. So yeah,
and it's a must.
Basically, and usually what you end up doing is ramming Cherno in the faces to try and get them to bump and, like, do you want that focus? Because you're not going to clear it next turn. And Cherno can bump and Dauntless, and he just doesn't care.
Yeah.
Just Dauntless also works into your own ships. So if you have to bump into your own ship, you're not that bothered. You can still get an action.
Well, I remember watching Corentin play this at the Sith group in this Decimator build, and he took like 7 damage on Cherno between electronic baffle and Dauntless bumps, and he just didn't care because his opponents were very clearly never going to turn on Cherno ever. So, you know, on like turn 2 or 3, he just like made a decision, right? You're not going after my rack, so I'm going to pile him into the middle now and just do tons of self damage and fly over rocks and stuff to get myself in the position that I need to be in, because he's got so much health that if you don't make the choice to take him out on like turn 1, you're probably not going to get him by the end of the game, unless the Cherno player makes a real, real big mistake. I think it's interesting that you point out this list has got like a lot of trade. I flew into a version with Rack and the 2 bombers, and weirdly enough, the person sort of flanked up one side with Rack where I wasn't, but hung back with the bombers, waiting until I committed across to Rack, and then smashed the bombers into the side of me because they flew so, like, they just slow rolled the bombers up the middle, trying to wait for me to overextend the middle to get the flank with Jendon and Cherno on either side. But because I was impatient, I swung everything over towards Rack and just gave my backside to Jendon and my flank to the bombers. And it was kind of an all-in, all-or-nothing kind of move to try and grab, like, get the points on Cherno and then get turned around to deal with everything else. And it didn't work out at all. It was such a bad choice. But it was one of those learning games where I was like, well, I know not to ever do that again.
I guess, like you said there, that's something that most people don't really do.
Yeah.
Like, most of the time, people think the bombers, they look at the bombers, they've not got, like, they've got 2 green, they've not got a lot of hull, there's no shields. They look like they're going to be just an easy kill. But it's what they do before they go. What you've got to watch out, especially because when I run it, I've got 2 Ruthlesses. I have it on Ferroth as well. So they're just there. You know, there's a lot of heavily modded attacks coming in for relatively easy to acquire. You know, like Jendon does it on his own. I mean, with the bombers and Ruthless, they just have to be near the attack. It's very easy to trigger.
So what's the strategy against these, Tim? We know that you beat Mr. Chambly in round 10 or 8 or 5 or something. So what was your tactic into this? How did you approach it?
So I'd played another Jendon list. I'm just trying to remember exactly. I think I might have just ignored Jendon pretty much. What scenario did we play? Because that might have had a big difference. Where's... I'm doing a quick look and roll better. Me. Where am I? I'm there. I can't remember what score. I thought it was a close game, but
it was. I think the game that we thought you were going to offer an ID, and then you said, "No, I fancy this one."
Yeah, I can kill the bombers, so I was quite happy with those. So we had Deathfire. I'm just trying to think if Deathfire. I knew Deathfire was going to chuck a proton bomb, and I kind of accepted the fact that everything was going to take a damage. Why does it not tell me what scenario we played that round? So it's round 5, whatever scenario that was.
Salvage mission.
Yeah, so I probably just outscored him on objectives, to be fair. So I think I am. So yes, Deathfire came in, chucked a proton bomb. Oh, that was it. Yeah, I remember now. So just the positional play on his rack. He just kind of got him a bit jammed up behind some obstacles, and then I went and grabbed lots of objectors and just went, sure, I'm going to take damage, but I'm just going to try and keep outscoring objectors. I think I've probably killed one, if not both, bombers. Should be the scores up here, round 5.
Yeah, you got 17-11.
Yeah, so I may have even killed Rack, in fairness. So I have got a jamming beam on Killer. So I can get rid of that reinforce if I want to. But then also I've got 7 ships shooting. I can just get lots of shots.
Yeah, so kind of the high level strategy for it is pick something that you're going to go after. Because Jendon, I think in these lists, doesn't have the pulp support. So one of the things with Jendon, when we saw Chris Black do well with him at the Sith Taker Open, was he had the Pulp Reaper supporting him the whole way through, which Chris was like, had always said, yeah, you just spend the shields all the time, because once Jendon's down his shields and he's down to his 3 hull, he's basically unkillable. You just take an evade and fly away with him. And, you know, he's done his damage at that point. He's come in and murdered some stuff. Now you just disappear with him. You've got Pulp's Force, you've got your own evade token, you've got 3 green dice. You're not going to die. Except for some extreme weird edges.
So game 1, I played Jendon, Vader, size 6, 2 Obsidian Squadrons. He was far too cagey with Vader and Jendon, so I basically just outscored him. I killed, I killed his TIE fighters pretty much unopposed. Mm-hmm. And then I just kill boxed Jendon and blocked Jendon onto obstacle and all sorts. It was horrible. I feel against Chambly that I probably got rid of both bombers fairly cheaply, and then it was just a case of almost ignoring Jendon for a certain extent and just keep scoring points, and mm-hmm. probably went after Rack. I'd have to possibly look through my pictures. So now I also played Duncan Howard, and he had Vader, Jendon, Tomix Bren, and Feroff. I had some decent shots, or half-decent shots into Vader, but everything just bounced. And I just wasn't able to land any damage, but I think mm-hmm. I still was able to put some, damage into Tomax and Feroff. And I think that's it. Certainly Vader is a lot squishier than Jendon if you can catch him. But then, just killboxing Jendon in amongst my swarm. Literally, I think there's a lovely picture of all 7 ships just surrounding Jendon, and there's just nowhere for him to run. And he just takes multiple shots, and he does eventually die, but That decimator
takes a bit of time, right?
Well, yeah. So the decimator actually can be really annoying into Republic, because one tactic I had with my Republic list is that some of my ships will do scenario actions or take target locks because I can get green tokens from other ships. But with mm-hmm. Vader crew, that means you haven't got that defense against Vader crew, and you just take the 1 damage. And with my ships, I've got 4 health. Death Troopers is annoying, but not as terrible. And normally, if I get to a point where my swarm's in and amongst the Decimator, I'm probably just shooting everything into the Decimator, try and kill it as quickly as I can.
I think Death Troopers is one of those upgrades that if you're aware of it, it's less annoying than if your opponent just goes, on turn 4, oh, Death Troopers, you can't clear that stress, and you go, oh, crap. You need to be hyper aware that it's there.
And I know I keep sort of banging on, but again, this is one way that the Republic get around that, is that there might be a couple of ships that are stressed, can't clear the stress because of Death Troopers. Oh, wait, I can pass them a green token from this other ship or something like that. So there are ways to get around Death Troopers. Vader can be very annoying because that's start of engagement phase, so you can kind of snipe ships with it.
Yeah, it's very good. Like we talked before about like highly modified attacks. And these ships have got highly modified attacks. So Rack has got his own ability. If he takes a reinforce, he gets a free focus mod, and Ruthless so that he can push damage on other things. Deathfire has got a crap attack, but really, really bad. Really good bombs, and a really good way to get bombs exactly where they want them to be. Tomax has got a double modded plasma torpedo every other turn for free, and Jendon has got all the mods he could ever want and then more. Like literally too many mods. It's like triple modded, but you can't use them all.
Proton cannon.
Yeah, and a five dice proton cannon if he feels like it.
Interesting point to discuss then is Jendon and Click. So you might see Click a little bit. He's not massively in the meta anymore. But basically, Click's ability where I can deny range bonus on the shot basically always trumps Jendon. But it comes down to player order in how we activate our abilities. So you can spend your shield to apply the range one bonus, and then I can click to take it away. So you've just spent your shield for nothing.
Yep.
But if I'm first player, I have to declare if I'm going to click the attack before you determine. So if I click, then you just don't bother. And if I don't click, then you know you can do it and get your range one bonus.
So here's the interesting thing. If I'm Jendon and I say, I'm going to spend a shield to get a range one bonus, and you say, I'm click, I'm going to prevent you from applying range bonuses to this attack, and it's a range three attack, you don't get your range three dice.
No, absolutely.
So you not only take away my additional dice for my range one, inverted commas, proton cannon or whatever, but you also take away your additional green. So it's a bit of a weird edge case of rules interactions, but you do have to.
Because I played three Jendons, it was like start of the game, I just went, this is what they've ruled. Just so that they're aware. Certainly when it's like a four ship list, it is very easy for me to be able to have click in a position to affect Jendon. But I don't think I actually used it at all, in fairness. Like, I didn't really care. Like, in a couple of the games, Jendon just wasn't affecting me, and I just could outscore him on objectives and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, Liam, from your perspective, kind of, if you look at this, I'll say this kind of combo of Imperial, it's mostly we're looking at the Rack builds, Rack plus some other stuff, right? Rack bombers plus seven other points of things. What's your brain say when you look at it across the table?
Again, so because I look at this from an FO point of view, I see Rack as 7 points because he will not have that reinforce. I can kind of jump on him if I need to. I'm also looking at Vader as well. If I can shut down that third dice that he carries using the ability and his lock, then I'm in a good place because the two things that do a lot of damage to me can be nullified. But again, I can fly my list kind of loose. The only kind of ball and chain I've got in there is Whirlwind with Midnight. But because I've got three sources of jam in Whirlwind, Von Reg, and Kylo, I can kind of pick and choose my targets. But the issue is if he comes to the first engagement with all three of those, Rack, Vader, and Tomax, that's where things get a bit hairy. I need to pick something, take it off, and just pray nothing kills me. Now, Vader will probably be the one thing that I have to ignore because he's going to do like a three bank afterburners boost into range, then do everything he wants to do. So I can't see him as a primary target. The idea of my list is probably nuke the Decimator, see what damage I can put into Tomax, kill Tomax afterwards, then see what resources I have left and pray I've got enough resources to deal with whatever's remaining and hopefully win on objective points after that.
So I'm just looking down the two people who finished kind of in the top eight. Well, two of the three people who finished in the top eight so far, and I think only one, and I think it's Jeremy Chambly, Chumbalaya's list, who hit first order. He hit first order twice. So he hit Kester in round seven, and then he hit somebody else kind of in round three. And he hit Fan in round 10. So that was the play-in. So Jeremy played against three similar first order squads and beat them all. So there's something happening that, well, I don't know. Like, I don't know how close the games were. Probably frighteningly close when it came to the kind of games against sort of Fan and Kester, because they're both kind of very good players with their first orders. Let's have a look. He says quickly, "Oh no." It was not a very close game at all in round 10 against Fan. It was 23-8. So I don't know what's happened there. It's weird, like, because I look at that list with four ships, including a Decimator, and I think that a five-ship first order list with Kylo's Bullseye lined up across the Decimator and a whole bunch of very good shots going into it, it means that they're basically going to lose the Decimator really quickly. Doesn't seem to have happened? Question mark? I don't know.
No, so one thing I've kind of noticed about other people's FO at the moment, when it comes to the Whispers, people aren't really taking sensor scramblers, which is what I prefer to use.
Mm-hmm.
So they can get those locks early. They can really get some damage in, whereas I like to get in and amongst my opponent and then just start doing damage. So they are taking shots at range three early on, whereas I will be taking shots, but it's highly unlikely I take damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Just conscious of time, so we'll do resistance and we'll do Paris scum as well next week when we're talking about some other stuff. We'll continue this. It's felt like an interesting bit of conversation. Hopefully you guys have found it useful as well. As we wrap up, I'm just going to reiterate that Sith Taker Open 25 tickets are 25 sounds like it's the 25th one we've run. Sith Taker Open 2025 tickets, which is happening on the 1st and 2nd of February next year. Tickets will be going live on the 30th of April at 10 a.m. at elementgames.co.uk. If you scroll down to the bottom for event tickets, you'll find the link there. But we will also post it around on our Facebook pages and Discords and stuff shortly after it goes live. Last year it sold out in about 28 hours. So the reason we're doing it this way this year is so that everybody can be prepared to grab a ticket if they really want to get one, and then nobody's going to miss out. Anything else that you wanted to mention, Tim?
So hot off the press, it's just been announced that Adeptcon 2025 is moving to Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, yeah. I think Alice Cooper pointed out.
Isn't that the home of the drill? Oh. Little tradesman joke for you there that you don't know.
Good job. Okay. So that's about 90 minutes north of Chicago. No, sort of 90 minutes north drive. So it's still on Lake Michigan, but obviously is a change, which will be good for some people, bad for others. So that is end of March. Obviously, we have no idea about any details regarding X-Wing Worlds 2025, but you could pretty much guarantee if there is going to be one, it's going to be at Adepticon.
Yep. So Adepticon is moving to Wisconsin.
Yep.
which has got the highest rate of alcoholism in the known world.
Has it?
Above Ireland? No.
Oh, it's a joke from Worlds this year. Apologies to everybody who's not the about four people who'll get exactly what I'm talking about when I come. Travis Johansson, one of our resistance friends, is from Wisconsin, and he just constantly likes making jokes about the I say jokes, maybe he's just dropping truth bombs.
So I will say, actually, it is possibly something that may interest me more in going back to Wales, because I was a bit like I was going to have a year off, but if it's going to a new city, new things to see and do, so
yeah,
might interest me.
So it's a more expensive trip, just from a quick scan down the people who are already looking at it. It's a couple of $100 more in a
well, it looks for
to
us
fly to Milwaukee.
So we would probably still end up flying into Chicago and then getting
somehow.
Up. Well, you probably end up just getting a connecting flight from Chicago O'Hare up to Milwaukee International, wherever it's called. But not as easy internationally to get to, I don't think. There are some flights. I think there was one possibly changing Atlanta going from Manchester. So there's possibly other routes to look into, so be interesting.
You could just swim up Lake Michigan. It's not that big, is it?
Is there less crime in Milwaukee?
I'm going to say probably. I'm not sure, that's though. Fun. Not judging from the amount of alcohol Travis says that they drink.
Maybe
there's sound that funny coming from where Liam lives.
Maybe too drunk to crime.
Possibly. All right, cool. So Milwaukee. So start looking that up. A lot of people already are, so that's cool. Liam, have you anything else?
I believe there's a train you can get.
No, I think I'm good.
Okay.
Chat to Border Grub.
What we said? We've not done shout outs yet. I mean, we are. No. Ben, what were we saying?
I just said I've seen somewhere that there's a train from wherever you land to Milwaukee.
Oh, from Chicago up to Milwaukee.
Yeah, I don't know how long it takes.
Be all right.
I imagine I'll still be too poor from buying a house by then.
Are you still moving in?
Yeah. No, well, obviously, yeah. We haven't been for years. Since we moved into this house, we're in the last house for 5 years, and we brought boxes that we brought to that house to this house and just put them straight back in the loft. That's nice. What adults do.
Proper grown-ups.
It's easy when you've only got one room, Liam.
I use a bathroom as well.
Has anybody got any shout-outs that they want to do before we continue to rag on Liam? Sorry, Tim, were you going to say something there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, all fun in NCX. So the Berserkers, my team, we've decided to swap factions. So I will be parking Republic for a bit, and I will be flying First Order, because it worked out so well for you in NCX last year.
Yeah, I don't believe in First Order as a concept. I think they're a lie that people tell their children to keep.
I think you love the Resistance that much that it just burns your soul to use the bad guys for them. Well,
you know, the thing I like about Resistance the most is the Resistance bombers, and I can't even have those. So
I think I'm playing. I think it's Velvet Buddha, and it's CIS at chance engagement.
I don't know about you, but Velvet Buddha had the best short shorts and pop socks on for the whole of Worlds, and it was amazing.
What are pop socks?
Little knee socks. Little trainers and knee socks.
Oh, short shorts. Terrible.
Yeah.
You're like normal socks to Liam, because he's a giant.
looked fabulous. Like, in a room full of blokes in shorts and black t-shirts, there was Liam wearing his not you, Liam, obviously, because you weren't there, but Liam Lee was wearing an X-Wing helmet for the entire event that matched the paint scheme on the ships that he was using, and then there was Velvet Buddha, who was wearing short shorts and pop socks and a crop top, and looked fabulous. It was wonderful. Like, just a little breath of fresh air and a sea of denim and black t-shirts. So, right.
How short are we talking? Are we talking like buttock hanging out?
Oh, yeah, there was definite buttock.
Oh, that's a man after my own heart. I mean, if you're going to wear short shorts, you've got to wear
short shorts.
Shorts.
Yeah. Don't say you're going to wear short shorts and then wear three-quarter length cargo pants. So there's got to be short shorts. Got to be Daisy Dukes.
I'll always remember you turning up to one of our events in a wife view with a sip take a look.
It was 30 degrees just, in Element Games that day.
You said you were going to do it and everyone thought you were joking and then you turned up in it. It was amazing.
It was the one who goes after that.
Oh yeah, there's pictures.
And he'd got one of the our iron-on logos on it as well. It was brilliant.
I did. I got an iron-on patch and ironed it on the night before, so that it was there. So I was branded. It was amazing. I was cooler than most other people. Not, you know, stylistically cool, but temperature-wise, it was definitely fine. All right, we'll knock it on the head there. We'll leave it. Just thanks very much for joining me again tonight. I've really enjoyed the conversation. And thank you very much for listening. It's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Liam.
Toodles.
Goodbye from Ben.
Bye.
And goodbye from me. Speak to you next time. Bye-bye.